Talking of the prices of birds, I've seen an ostrich that cost £300, said the taxidermist, recalling his youth of travel. £300. He looked at me over his spectacles. I've seen another that was refused at £4. No, he said, it wasn't any fancy points. They was just plain ostriches. A little off color, too, owing to dietary. And there wasn't any particular restriction of the demand either. You'd have thought 5 ostriches would have ruled cheap on an East Indiaman. But the point was, one of them had swallowed a diamond. The chap it got it off was Sir Mohini Padisha, a tremendous swell, a Piccadilly swell you might say up to the neck of him, and then an ugly black head and a whopping turban, with this diamond in it. The blessed bird pecked suddenly and had it, and when the chap made a fuss it realized it had done wrong, I suppose, and went and mixed itself with the others to preserve its incog. It all happened in a minute. I was among the first to arrive, and there was this heathen going over his gods, and 2 sailors and the man who had charge of the birds laughing fit to split. It was a rummy way of losing a jewel, come to think of it. The man in charge hadn't been about just at the moment, so that he didn't know which bird it was. Clean lost, you see. I didn't feel half sorry, to tell you the truth. The beggar had been swaggering over his blessed diamond ever since he came aboard. A thing like that goes from stem to stern of a ship in no time. Everyone was talking about it. Padisha went below to hide his feelings. At dinner he pigged at a table by himself, him and 2 other Hindus. The captain kind of jeered at him about it, and he got very excited. He turned round and talked into my ear. He would not buy the birds, he would have his diamond. He demanded his rights as a British subject. His diamond must be found. He was firm upon that. He would appeal to the House of Lords. The man in charge of the birds was one of those wooden-headed chaps you can't get a new idea into anyhow. He refused any proposal to interfere with the birds by way of medicine. His instructions were to feed them so-and-so and treat them so-and-so, and it was as much as his place was worth not to feed them so-and-so and treat them so-and-so. Padisha had wanted a stomach pump, though you can't do that to a bird, you know. This Padisha was full of bad law, like most of these blessed Bengalis, and talked of having a lien on the birds, and so forth. But an old boy, who said his son was a London barrister, argued that what a bird swallowed became ipso facto part of the bird, and that Padisha's only remedy lay in an action for damages, and even then it might be possible to show contributory negligence. He hadn't any right of way about an ostrich that didn't belong to him. That upset Padisha extremely, the more so as most of us expressed an opinion that that was the reasonable view. There wasn't any lawyer aboard to settle the matter, so we all talked pretty free. At last, after Aidan, it appears that he came round to the general opinion, and went privately to the man in charge and made an offer for all 5 ostriches. The next morning there was a fine shindy at breakfast. The man hadn't any authority to deal with the birds, and nothing on earth would induce him to sell, but it seems he told Padisha that a Eurasian named Potter had already made him an offer, and on that Padisha denounced Potter before us all. But I think the most of us thought it rather smart of Potter, and I know that when Potter said that he'd wired at Aden to London to buy the birds, and would have an answer at Suez, I cursed pretty richly at a lost opportunity. At Suez, Padisha gave way to tears, actual wet tears, when Potter became the owner of the birds, and offered him 250 right off for the 5, being more than 200% on what Potter had given. Potter said he'd be hanged if he parted with a feather of them, that he meant to kill them off one by one and find the diamond, but afterwards, thinking it over, he relented a little. He was a gambling hound, was this Potter, a little queer at cards, and this kind of prize packet business must have suited him down to the ground. Anyhow, he offered, for a lark, to sell the birds separately to separate people by auction at a starting price of 80 for a bird. But one of them, he said, he meant to keep for luck. You must understand this diamond was a valuable one. A little Jew chap, a diamond merchant, who was with us, had put it at 3 or 4,000 when Padisha had shown it to him, and this idea of an ostrich gamble caught on. Now it happened that I'd been having a few talks on general subjects with the man who looked after these ostriches, and quite incidentally he'd said one of the birds was ailing, and he fancied it had indigestion. It had one feather in its tail almost all white, by which I knew it, and so when, next day, the auction started with it, I capped Padisha's 85 by 90. I fancy I was a bit too sure and eager with my bid, and some of the others spotted the fact that I was in the know. And Padisha went for that particular bird like an irresponsible lunatic. At last the Jew diamond merchant got it for 175, and Padisha said 180 just after the hammer came down, so Potter declared. At any rate the Jew merchant secured it, and there and then he got a gun and shot it. Potter made a Hades of a fuss because he said it would injure the sale of the other 3, and Padisha, of course, behaved like an idiot, but all of us were very much excited. I can tell you I was precious glad when that dissection was over, and no diamond had turned up precious glad. I'd gone to 140 on that particular bird myself. The little Jew was like most Jews, he didn't make any great fuss over bad luck, but Potter declined to go on with the auction until it was understood that the goods could not be delivered until the sale was over. The little Jew wanted to argue that the case was exceptional, and as the discussion ran pretty even, the thing was postponed until the next morning. We had a lively dinner table that evening, I can tell you, but in the end Potter got his way, since it would stand to reason he would be safer if he stuck to all the birds, and that we owed him some consideration for his sportsmanlike behavior. And the old gentleman whose son was a lawyer said he'd been thinking the thing over and that it was very doubtful if, when a bird had been opened and the diamond recovered, it ought not to be handed back to the proper owner. I remember I suggested it came under the laws of treasure trove, which was really the truth of the matter. There was a hot argument, and we settled it was certainly foolish to kill the bird on board the ship. Then the old gentleman, going at large through his legal talk, tried to make out the sale was a lottery and illegal, and appealed to the captain, but Potter said he sold the birds as ostriches. He didn't want to sell any diamonds, he said, and didn't offer that as an inducement. The three birds he put up, to the best of his knowledge and belief, did not contain a diamond. It was in the one he kept, so he hoped. Prices ruled high next day all the same. The fact that now there were four chances instead of five of course caused a rise. The blessed birds averaged 227, and, oddly enough, this Potisha didn't secure one of them, not one. He made too much shindy, and when he ought to have been bidding he was talking about liens, and, besides, Potter was a bit down on him. One fell to a quiet little officer chap, another to the little Jew, and the third was syndicated by the engineers. And then Potter seemed suddenly sorry for having sold them, and said he'd flung away a clear £1,000, and that very likely he'd draw a blank and that he always had been a fool, but when I went and had a bit of a talk to him, with the idea of getting him to hedge on his last chance, I found he'd already sold the bird he'd reserved to a political chap that was on board, a chap who'd been studying Indian morals and social questions in his vacation. That last was the £300 bird. Well, they landed three of the blessed creatures at Brindisi, though the old gentleman said it was a breach of the customs regulations, and Potter and Potisha landed too. The Hindu seemed half mad as he saw his blessed diamond going this way and that, so to speak. He kept on saying he'd get an injunction, he had injunction on the brain, and giving his name and address to the chaps who'd bought the birds, so that they'd know where to send the diamond. None of them wanted his name and address, and none of them would give their own. It was a fine row, I can tell you, on the platform. They all went off by different trains. I came on to Southampton, and there I saw the last of the birds. As I came ashore, it was the one the engineers bought, and it was standing up near the bridge, in a kind of crate, and looking as leggy and silly a setting for a valuable diamond as ever you saw, if it was a setting for a valuable diamond. How did it end? Oh. Like that. Well, perhaps. Yes, there's one more thing that may throw light on it. A week or so after landing I was down Regent Street doing a bit of shopping, and who should I see arm in arm and having a purple time of it but Potisha and Potter. If you come to think of it. Yes. I've thought that. Only, you see, there's no doubt the diamond was real. And Potisha was an eminent Hindu. I've seen his name in the papers often. But whether the bird swallowed the diamond certainly is another matter, as you say. A man with a white face entered the carriage at Rugby. He moved slowly in spite of the urgency of his porter, and even while he was still on the platform I noted how ill he seemed. He dropped into the corner over against me with a sigh, made an incomplete attempt to arrange his traveling shawl, and became motionless, with his eyes staring vacantly. Presently he was moved by a sense of my observation, looked up at me, and put out a spiritless hand for his newspaper. Then he glanced again in my direction. I feigned to read. I feared I had unwittingly embarrassed him, and in a moment I was surprised to find him speaking. "I beg your pardon?" said I. "That book," he repeated, pointing a lean finger, "is about dreams." "Obviously," I answered, for it was Fortnum Roscoe's Dream States, and the title was on the cover. He hung silent for a space as if he sought words. "Yes," he said at last, "but they tell you nothing." I did not catch his meaning for a second. "They don't know," he added. I looked a little more attentively at his face. "There are dreams," he said, "and dreams. That sort of proposition I never dispute." I suppose he hesitated. "Do you ever dream? I mean vividly." "I dream very little," I answered. "I doubt if I have three vivid dreams in a year." "Ah," he said, and seemed for a moment to collect his thoughts. "Your dreams don't mix with your memories?" he asked abruptly. "You don't find yourself in doubt, did this happen or did it not?" "Hardly ever. Except just for a momentary hesitation now and then. I suppose few people do." "Does he say?" he indicated the book. Says it happens at times and gives the usual explanation about intensity of impression and the like to account for its not happening as a rule. I suppose you know something of these theories. Very little except that they are wrong. His emaciated hand played with the strap of the window for a time. I prepared to resume reading, and that seemed to precipitate his next remark. He leant forward almost as though he would touch me. Isn't there something called consecutive dreaming that goes on night after night? I believe there is. There are cases given in most books on mental trouble. Mental trouble? Yes. I dare say there are. It's the right place for them. But what I mean, he looked at his bony knuckles. Is that sort of thing always dreaming? Is it dreaming? Or is it something else? Mightn't it be something else? I should have snubbed his persistent conversation but for the drawn anxiety of his face. I remember now the look of his faded eyes and the lid's red stain. Perhaps you know that look. I'm not just arguing about a matter of opinion, he said. The thing's killing me. Dreams? If you call them dreams. Night after night. Vivid. So vivid. This, he indicated the landscape that went streaming by the window, seems unreal in comparison. I can scarcely remember who I am, what business I am on. He paused. Even now. The dream is always the same, do you mean? I asked. It's over. You mean? I died. Died? Smashed and killed, and now, so much of me as that dream was, is dead. Dead forever. I dreamt I was another man, you know, living in a different part of the world and in a different time. I dreamt that night after night. Night after night I woke into that other life. Fresh scenes and fresh happenings until I came upon the last. When you died. When I died. And since then? No, he said. Thank God. That was the end of the dream. It was clear I was in for this dream. And after all, I had an hour before me, the light was fading fast, and Fortnum Roscoe has a dreary way with him. Living in a different time, I said, do you mean in some different age? Yes. Past? No, to come. The year 3000, for example? I don't know what year it was. I did when I was asleep, when I was dreaming, that is, but not now that I am awake. There's a lot of things I have forgotten since I woke out of these dreams, though I knew them at the time when I suppose it was dreaming. They called the year differently from our way of calling the year. What did they call it? He put his hand to his forehead. No, said he, I forget. He sat smiling weakly. For a moment I feared he did not mean to tell me his dream. As a rule I hate people who tell their dreams, but this struck me differently. I proffered assistance even. It began, I suggested. It was vivid from the first. I seemed to wake up in it suddenly. And it's curious that in these dreams I am speaking of, I never remember this life I am living now. It seemed as if the dream life was enough while it lasted. Perhaps, but I will tell you how I find myself when I do my best to recall it all. I don't remember anything clearly until I found myself sitting in a sort of loggia looking out over the sea. I had been dozing, and suddenly I woke up fresh and vivid, not a bit dreamlike, because the girl had stopped fanning me. The girl? Yes, the girl. You must not interrupt or you will put me out. He stopped abruptly. You won't think I'm mad? He said. No, I answered. You've been dreaming. Tell me your dream. I woke up, I say, because the girl had stopped fanning me. I was not surprised to find myself there or anything of that sort, you understand. I did not feel I had fallen into it suddenly. I simply took it up at that point. Whatever memory I had of this life, this 19th century life, faded as I woke, vanished like a dream. I knew all about myself, knew that my name was no longer Cooper but Heaton, and all about my position in the world. I've forgotten a lot since I woke. There's a one of connection, but it was all quite clear and matter of fact then. He hesitated again, gripping the window strap, putting his face forward and looking up to me appealingly. This seems bosh to you? No, no, I cried. Go on. Tell me what this loggia was like. It was not really a loggia, I don't know what to call it. It faced south. It was small. It was all in shadow except the semicircle above the balcony that showed the sky and sea in the corner where the girl stood. I was on a couch. It was a metal couch with light striped cushions, and the girl was leaning over the balcony with her back to me. The light of the sunrise fell on her ear and cheek. Her pretty white neck and the little curls that nestled there, and her white shoulder were in the sun, and all the grace of her body was in the cool blue shadow. She was dressed, how can I describe it? It was easy and flowing. And altogether there she stood, so that it came to me how beautiful and desirable she was, as though I had never seen her before. And when at last I sighed and raised myself upon my arm, she turned her face to me. He stopped. I have lived 53 years in this world. I have had mother, sisters, friends, wife and daughters, all their faces, the play of their faces, I know. But the face of this girl, it is much more real to me. I can bring it back into memory so that I see it again, I could draw it or paint it. And after all. He stopped, but I said nothing. The face of a dream, the face of a dream. She was beautiful. Not that beauty which is terrible, cold, and worshipful, like the beauty of a saint, nor that beauty that stirs fierce passions, but a sort of radiation, sweet lips that softened into smiles, and grave gray eyes. And she moved gracefully, she seemed to have part with all pleasant and gracious things. He stopped, and his face was downcast and hidden. Then he looked up at me and went on, making no further attempt to disguise his absolute belief in the reality of his story. You see, I had thrown up my plans and ambitions, thrown up all I had ever worked for or desired for her sake. I had been a master man away there in the north, with influence and property and a great reputation, but none of it had seemed worth having beside her. I had come to the place, this city of sunny pleasures with her, and left all those things to wreck and ruin just to save a remnant at least of my life. While I had been in love with her before I knew that she had any care for me, before I had imagined that she would dare that we should dare, all my life had seemed vain and hollow, dust and ashes. It was dust and ashes. Night after night and through the long days I had longed and desired, my soul had beaten against the thing forbidden. But it is impossible for one man to tell another just these things. It's emotion, it's a tint, a light that comes and goes. Only while it's there, everything changes, everything. The thing is, I came away and left them in their crisis to do what they could. Left whom? I asked, puzzled. The people up in the north there. You see, in this dream, anyhow, I had been a big man, the sort of man men come to trust in, to group themselves about. Millions of men who had never seen me were ready to do things and risk things because of their confidence in me. I had been playing that game for years, that big laborious game, that vague, monstrous political game amidst intrigues and betrayals, speech and agitation. It was a vast weltering world, and at last I had a sort of leadership against the gang, you know it was called the gang, a sort of compromise of scoundrelly projects and base ambitions and vast public emotional stupidities and catchwords, the gang that kept the world noisy and blind year by year, and all the while that it was drifting, drifting towards infinite disaster. But I can't expect you to understand the shades and complications of the year something or other ahead. I had it all down to the smallest details in my dream. I suppose I had been dreaming of it before I awoke, and the fading outline of some queer new development I had imagined still hung about me as I rubbed my eyes. It was some grubby affair that made me thank God for the sunlight. I sat up on the couch and remained looking at the woman and rejoicing that I had come away out of all that tumult and folly and violence before it was too late. After all, I thought, this is life, love and beauty, desire and delight, are they not worth all those dismal struggles for vague, gigantic ends? And I blamed myself for having ever sought to be a leader when I might have given my days to love. But then, thought I, if I had not spent my early days sternly and austerely, I might have wasted myself upon vain and worthless women, and at the thought all my being went out in love and tenderness to my dear mistress, my dear lady, who had come at last and compelled me by her invincible charm for me to lay that life aside. You are worth it, I said, speaking without intending her to hear, you are worth it, my dearest one. Worth pride and praise and all things. Love. To have you is worth them all together. And at the murmur of my voice she turned about. Come and see, she cried, I can hear her now, come and see the sunrise upon Monte Solaro. I remember how I sprang to my feet and joined her at the balcony. She put a white hand upon my shoulder and pointed towards great masses of limestone, flushing, as it were, into life. I looked. But first I noted the sunlight on her face caressing the lines of her cheeks and neck. How can I describe to you the scene we had before us? We were at Capri. I have been there, I said. I have clambered up Monte Solaro and drunk Vero Capri muddy stuff like cider at the summit. Ah, said the man with the white face, then perhaps you can tell me, you will know if this is indeed Capri. For in this life I have never been there. Let me describe it. We were in a little room, one of a vast multitude of little rooms, very cool and sunny, hollowed out of the limestone of a sort of cape, very high above the sea. The whole island, you know, was one enormous hotel, complex beyond explaining, and on the other side there were miles of floating hotels, and huge floating stages to which the flying machines came. They called it a pleasure city. Of course, there was none of that in your time, rather, I should say, is none of that now. Of course. Now. Yes. Well, this room of ours was at the extremity of the cape, so that one could see east and west. Eastward was a great cliff 1,000 feet high, perhaps coldly grey except for one bright edge of gold, and beyond it the Isle of the Sirens, and a falling coast that faded and passed into the hot sunrise. And when one turned to the west, distinct and near was a little bay, a little beach still in shadow. And out of that shadow rose Solaro straight and tall, flushed and golden crested, like a beauty throned, and the white moon was floating behind her in the sky. And before us from east to west stretched the many-tinted sea all dotted with little sailing boats. To the eastward, of course, these little boats were grey and very minute and clear, but to the westward they were little boats of gold shining gold almost like little flames. And just below us was a rock with an arch worn through it. The blue seawater broke to green and foam all round the rock, and a galley came gliding out of the arch. "I know that rock," I said. "I was nearly drowned there. It is called the Feraglione."
"I Feraglione?"
"Yes, she called it that," answered the man with a white face. "There was some story but that." He put his hand to his forehead again. "No," he said, "I forget that story. Well, that is the first thing I remember, the first dream I had, that little shaded room and the beautiful air and sky and that dear lady of mine, with her shining arms and her graceful robe, and how we sat and talked in half whispers to one another. We talked in whispers not because there was any one to hear, but because there was still such a freshness of mind between us that our thoughts were a little frightened, I think, to find themselves at last in words. And so they went softly. Presently we were hungry and we went from our apartment, going by a strange passage with a moving floor, until we came to the great breakfast room. There was a fountain and music. A pleasant and joyful place it was, with its sunlight and splashing, and the murmur of plucked strings. And we sat and ate and smiled at one another, and I would not heed a man who was watching me from a table nearby. And afterwards we went on to the dancing hall. But I cannot describe that hall. The place was enormous, larger than any building you have ever seen, and in one place there was the old gate of Capri, caught into the wall of a gallery high overhead. Light girders, stems and threads of gold, burst from the pillars like fountains, streamed like an aurora across the roof and interlaced, like conjuring tricks. All about the great circle for the dancers there were beautiful figures, strange dragons, and intricate and wonderful grotesques bearing lights. The place was inundated with artificial light that shamed the newborn day. And as we went through the throng the people turned about and looked at us, for all through the world my name and face were known, and how I had suddenly thrown up pride and struggle to come to this place. And they looked also at the lady beside me, though half the story of how at last she had come to me was unknown or mistold. And few of the men who were there, I know, but judged me a happy man, in spite of all the shame and dishonor that had come upon my name. The air was full of music, full of harmonious scents, full of the rhythm of beautiful motions. Thousands of beautiful people swarmed about the hall, crowded the galleries, sat in a myriad recesses. They were dressed in splendid colors and crowned with flowers. Thousands danced about the great circle beneath the white images of the ancient gods, and glorious processions of youths and maidens came and went. We too danced, not the dreary monotonies of your days of this time, I mean, but dances that were beautiful, intoxicating. And even now I can see my lady dancing joyously. She danced, you know, with a serious face, she danced with a serious dignity, and yet she was smiling at me and caressing me, smiling and caressing with her eyes. The music was different, he murmured. It went, I cannot describe it, but it was infinitely richer and more varied than any music that has ever come to me awake. And then it was when we had done dancing, a man came to speak to me. He was a lean, resolute man, very soberly clad for that place, and already I had marked his face watching me in the breakfasting hall, and afterwards as we went along the passage I had avoided his eye. But now, as we sat in a little alcove, smiling at the pleasure of all the people who went to and fro across the shining floor, he came and touched me, and spoke to me so that I was forced to listen. And he asked that he might speak to me for a little time apart. "No," I said. "I have no secrets from this lady. What do you want to tell me?" He said it was a trivial matter, or at least a dry matter, for a lady to hear. "Perhaps for me to hear," said I. He glanced at her, as though almost he would appeal to her. Then he asked me suddenly if I had heard of a great and avenging declaration that Evesham had made. Now, Evesham had always before been the man next to myself in the leadership of that great party in the North. He was a forcible, hard, and tactless man, and only I had been able to control and soften him. It was on his account even more than my own, I think, that the others had been so dismayed at my retreat. So this question about what he had done reawakened my old interest in the life I had put aside just for a moment. "I have taken no heed of any news for many days," I said. "What has Evesham been saying?" And with that the man began, nothing loath, and I must confess even I was struck by Evesham's reckless folly in the wild and threatening words he had used. And this messenger they had sent to me not only told me of Evesham's speech, but went on to ask counsel and to point out what need they had of me. While he talked, my lady sat a little forward and watched his face and mine. My old habits of scheming and organizing reasserted themselves. I could even see myself suddenly returning to the North, and all the dramatic effect of it. All that this man said witnessed to the disorder of the party indeed, but not to its damage. I should go back stronger than I had come. And then I thought of my lady. You see, how can I tell you? There were certain peculiarities of our relationship as things are I need not tell you about that which would render her presence with me impossible. I should have had to leave her, indeed, I should have had to renounce her clearly and openly, if I was to do all that I could do in the North. And the man knew that, even as he talked to her and me, knew it as well as she did, that my steps to duty were first, separation, then abandonment. At the touch of that thought my dream of a return was shattered. I turned on the man suddenly, as he was imagining his eloquence was gaining ground with me. "What have I to do with these things now?" I said. "I have done with them. Do you think I am coquetting with your people in coming here?" "No," he said. "But why cannot you leave me alone? I have done with these things. I have ceased to be anything but a private man." "Yes," he answered. "But have you thought? This talk of war, these reckless challenges, these wild aggressions." I stood up. "No," I cried. "I won't hear you. I took count of all those things, I weighed them and I have come away." He seemed to consider the possibility of persistence. He looked from me to where the lady sat regarding us. "War," he said, as if he were speaking to himself, and then turned slowly from me and walked away. I stood, caught in the whirl of thoughts his appeal had set going. I heard my lady's voice. "Dear," she said, "but if they had need of you." She did not finish her sentence, she let it rest there. I turned to her sweet face, and the balance of my mood swayed and reeled. "They want me only to do the thing they dare not do themselves," I said. "If they distrust Evesham, they must settle with him themselves." She looked at me doubtfully. "But war," she said. I saw a doubt on her face that I had seen before, a doubt of herself and me, the first shadow of the discovery that, seen strongly and completely, must drive us apart forever. Now, I was an older mind than hers, and I could sway her to this belief or that. "My dear one," I said, "you must not trouble over these things. There will be no war. Certainly there will be no war. The age of wars is past. Trust me to know the justice of this case. They have no right upon me, dearest, and no one has a right upon me. I have been free to choose my life, and I have chosen this." "But war," she said. I sat down beside her. I put an arm behind her and took her hand in mine. I set myself to drive that doubt away. I set myself to fill her mind with pleasant things again. I lied to her, and in lying to her I lied also to myself. And she was only too ready to believe me, only too ready to forget. Very soon the shadow had gone again, and we were hastening to our bathing place in the Grotta del Bovo Marino, where it was our custom to bathe every day. We swam and splashed one another, and in that buoyant water I seemed to become something lighter and stronger than a man. And at last we came out dripping and rejoicing and raced among the rocks. And then I put on a dry bathing dress, and we sat to bask in the sun, and presently I nodded, resting my head against her knee, and she put her hand upon my hair and stroked it softly and I dozed. And behold, as it were with the snapping of the string of a violin, I was awakening, and I was in my own bed in Liverpool, in the life of today. Only for a time I could not believe that all these vivid moments had been no more than the substance of a dream. In truth, I could not believe it a dream for all the sobering reality of things about me. I bathed and dressed as it were by habit, and as I shaved I argued why I of all men should leave the woman I loved to go back to fantastic politics in the hard and strenuous North. Even if Evesham did force the world back to war, what was that to me?
I was a man with the heart of a man, and why should I feel the responsibility of a deity for the way the world might go? You know that is not quite the way I think about affairs, about my real affairs. I am a solicitor, you know, with a point of view. The vision was so real, you must understand, so utterly unlike a dream that I kept perpetually recalling little irrelevant details. Even the ornament of the book cover that lay on my wife's sewing machine in the breakfast room recalled with the utmost vividness the guilt line that ran about the seat in the alcove where I had talked with the messenger from my deserted party. Have you ever heard of a dream that had a quality like that? Like? So that afterwards you remembered little details you had forgotten. I thought. I had never noticed the point before, but he was right. Never, I said. That is what you never seem to do with dreams. No, he answered. But that is just what I did. I am a solicitor, you must understand, in Liverpool, and I could not help wondering what the clients and business people I found myself talking to in my office would think if I told them suddenly I was in love with a girl who would be born a couple of hundred years or so hence, and worried about the politics of my great-great-great-grandchildren. I was chiefly busy that day negotiating a 99-year building lease. It was a private builder in a hurry, and we wanted to tie him in every possible way. I had an interview with him, and he showed a certain one of temper that sent me to bed still irritated. That night I had no dream. Nor did I dream the next night, at least, to remember. Something of that intense reality of conviction vanished. I began to feel sure it was a dream. And then it came again. When the dream came again, nearly 4 days later, it was very different. I think it's certain that 4 days had also elapsed in the dream. Many things had happened in the north, and the shadow of them was back again between us, and this time it was not so easily dispelled. I began, I know, with moody musings. Why, in spite of all, should I go back for all the rest of my days to toil and stress, insults and perpetual dissatisfaction, simply to save hundreds of millions of common people, whom I did not love, whom too often I could do no other than despise, from the stress and anguish of war and infinite misrule? And after all I might fail. They all sought their own narrow ends, and why should not I also live as a man? And out of such thoughts her voice summoned me, and I lifted my eyes. I found myself awake and walking. We had come out above the pleasure city, we were near the summit of Monte Solaro and looking towards the bay. It was the late afternoon and very clear. Far away to the left Ischia hung in a golden haze between sea and sky, and Naples was coldly white against the hills, and before us was Vesuvius with a tall and slender streamer feathering at last towards the south, and the ruins of Torre dell'Annunziata and Castellammare glittering and near. I interrupted suddenly, "You have been to Capri, of course?" "Only in this dream," he said, "only in this dream." All across the bay beyond Sorrento were the floating palaces of the pleasure city moored and chained. And northward were the broad floating stages that received the aeroplanes. Aeroplanes fell out of the sky every afternoon, each bringing its thousands of pleasure seekers from the uttermost parts of the earth to Capri and its delights. All these things, I say, stretched below. But we noticed them only incidentally because of an unusual sight that evening had to show. 5 war aeroplanes that had long slumbered useless in the distant arsenals of the Rheinmuth were maneuvering now in the eastward sky. Evesham had astonished the world by producing them and others, and sending them to circle here and there. It was the threat material in the great game of bluff he was playing, and it had taken even me by surprise. He was one of those incredibly stupid energetic people who seem sent by heaven to create disasters. His energy to the first glance seemed so wonderfully like capacity. But he had no imagination, no invention, only a stupid, vast, driving force of will, and a mad faith in his stupid idiot luck to pull him through. I remember how we stood upon the headland watching the squadron circling far away, and how I weighed the full meaning of the sight, seeing clearly the way things must go. And then even it was not too late. I might have gone back, I think, and saved the world. The people of the North would follow me, I knew, granted only that in one thing I respected their moral standards. The East and South would trust me as they would trust no other northern man. And I knew I had only to put it to her and she would have let me go. Not because she did not love me. Only I did not want to go, my will was all the other way about. I had so newly thrown off the incubus of responsibility, I was still so fresh a renegade from duty that the daylight clearness of what I ought to do had no power at all to touch my will. My will was to live, to gather pleasures and make my dear lady happy. But though this sense of vast neglected duties had no power to draw me, it could make me silent and preoccupied, It robbed the days I had spent of half their brightness and roused me into dark meditations in the silence of the night. And as I stood and watched Evesham's aeroplane sweep to and fro those birds of infinite ill omen, she stood beside me watching me, perceiving the trouble indeed, but not perceiving it clearly, her eyes questioning my face, her expression shaded with perplexity. Her face was grey because the sunset was fading out of the sky. It was no fault of hers that she held me. She had asked me to go from her, and again in the night time and with tears she had asked me to go. At last it was the sense of her that roused me from my mood. I turned upon her suddenly and challenged her to race down the mountain slopes. "No," she said, as if I had jarred with her gravity, but I was resolved to end that gravity, and make her run. No one can be very grey and sad who is out of breath, and when she stumbled I ran with my hand beneath her arm. We ran down past a couple of men, who turned back staring in astonishment at my behaviour. They must have recognised my face. And halfway down the slope came a tumult in the air, clang clank, clang clank, and we stopped, and presently over the hillcrest those war things came flying one behind the other. The man seemed hesitating on the verge of a description. "What were they like?" I asked. "They had never fought," he said. "They were just like our ironclads are nowadays, they had never fought. No one knew what they might do, with excited men inside them, few even cared to speculate. They were great driving things shaped like spearheads without a shaft, with a propeller in the place of the shaft."
"Steel?"
"Not steel."
"Aluminum?"
"No, no, nothing of that sort. An alloy that was very common as brass, for example. It was called, let me see," he squeezed his forehead with the fingers of one hand. "I am forgetting everything," he said.
"And they carried guns?"
"Little guns, firing high explosive shells. They fired the guns backwards, out of the base of the leaf, so to speak, and rammed with the beak. That was the theory, you know, but they had never been fought. No one could tell exactly what was going to happen. And meanwhile I suppose it was very fine to go whirling through the air like a flight of young swallows, swift and easy. I guess the captains tried not to think too clearly what the real thing would be like. And these flying war machines, you know, were only one sort of the endless war contrivances that had been invented and had fallen into abeyance during the long peace. There were all sorts of these things that people were routing out and furbishing up, infernal things, silly things, things that had never been tried, big engines, terrible explosives, great guns. You know the silly way of these ingenious sort of men who make these things, they turn them out as beavers build dams, and with no more sense of the rivers they're going to divert and the lands they're going to flood. As we went down the winding stepway to our hotel again, in the twilight, I foresaw it all. I saw how clearly and inevitably things were driving for war in Evesham's silly, violent hands, and I had some inkling of what war was bound to be under these new conditions. And even then, though I knew it was drawing near the limit of my opportunity, I could find no will to go back. He sighed. "That was my last chance. We didn't go into the city until the sky was full of stars, so we walked out upon the high terrace, to and fro, and she counseled me to go back. My dearest," she said, and her sweet face looked up to me, "this is death. This life you lead is death. Go back to them, go back to your duty." She began to weep, saying, between her sobs, and clinging to my arm as she said it, "Go back, go back." Then suddenly she fell mute, and, glancing down at her face, I read in an instant the thing she had thought to do. It was one of those moments when one sees.
"No,"
I said.
"No?"
she asked, in surprise and I think a little fearful at the answer to her thought. "Nothing," I said, "shall send me back. Nothing. I have chosen. Love, I have chosen, and the world must go. Whatever happens, I will live this life, I will live for you. It nothing shall turn me aside, nothing, my dear one. Even if you died, even if you died."
"Yes?"
she murmured, softly. "Then I also would die." And before she could speak again I began to talk, talking eloquently as I could do in that life, talking to exalt love, to make the life we were living seem heroic and glorious, and the thing I was deserting something hard and enormously ignoble that it was a fine thing to set aside. I bent all my mind to throw the glamour upon it, seeking not only to convert her but myself to that. We talked, and she clung to me, torn too between all that she deemed noble and all that she knew was sweet. And at last I did make it heroic, made all the thickening disaster of the world only a sort of glorious setting to our unparalleled love, and we two poor foolish souls strutted there at last, clad in that splendid delusion, drunken rather with that glorious delusion, under the still stars. And so my moment passed. It was my last chance. Even as we went to and fro there, the leaders of the South and East were gathering their resolve, and the hot answer that shattered Evesham's bluffing forever, took shape and waited. And, all over Asia, and the ocean, and the South, the air and the wires were throbbing with their warnings to prepare, prepare. No one living, you know, knew what war was. No one could imagine, with all these new inventions, what horror war might bring. I believe most people still believed it would be a matter of bright uniforms and shouting charges and triumphs and flags and bands in a time when half the world drew its food supply from regions 10,000 miles away. The man with the white face paused. I glanced at him, and his face was intent on the floor of the carriage. A little railway station, a string of loaded trucks, a signal box, and the back of a cottage, shot by the carriage window, and a bridge passed with a clap of noise, echoing the tumult of the train. After that, he said, I dreamt often. For 3 weeks of nights that dream was my life. And the worst of it was there were nights when I could not dream, when I lay tossing on a bed in this accursed life, and there somewhere lost to me things were happening momentous, terrible things. I lived at nights my days, my waking days, this life I am living now, became a faded, faraway dream, a drab setting, the cover of the book. He thought. I could tell you all, tell you every little thing in the dream. But as to what I did in the daytime, no. I could not tell, I do not remember. My memory has gone. The business of life slips from me. He leant forward, and pressed his hands upon his eyes. For a long time he said nothing. And then? Said I. The war burst like a hurricane. He stared before him at unspeakable things. And then? I urged again. One touch of unreality, he said, in the low tone of a man who speaks to himself, and they would have been nightmares. But they were not nightmares, they were not nightmares. No. He was silent for so long that it dawned upon me that there was a danger of losing the rest of the story. But he went on talking again in the same tone of questioning self-communion. What was there to do but flight? I had not thought the war would touch Capri. I had seemed to see Capri as being out of it all, as the contrast to it all, but 2 nights after the whole place was shouting and bawling, every woman almost and every other man wore a badge, Evesham's badge, and there was no music but a jangling war song over and over again, and everywhere men enlisting, and in the dancing halls they were drilling. The whole island was awhirl with rumors. It was said, again and again, that fighting had begun. I had not expected this. I had seen so little of the life of pleasure that I had failed to reckon with this violence of the amateurs. And as for me, I was out of it. I was like the man who might have prevented the firing of a magazine. The time had gone. I was no one, the vainest stripling with a badge counted for more than I. The crowd jostled us and bawled in our ears, that accursed song deafened us, a woman shrieked at my lady because no badge was on her, and we too went back to our own place again, ruffled and insulted my lady white and silent, and I quiver with rage.
So furious was I could have quarreled with her if I could have found one shade of accusation in her eyes.
All my magnificence had gone from me. I walked up and down our rock cell, and outside was the darkling sea and a light to the southward that flared and passed and came again. We must get out of this place, I said over and over. I have made my choice, and I will have no hand in these troubles. I will have nothing of this war. We have taken our lives out of all these things. This is no refuge for us. Let us go. And the next day we were already in flight from the war that covered the world. And all the rest was flight, all the rest was flight. He mused darkly. How much was there of it? He made no answer. How many days? His face was white and drawn and his hands were clenched. He took no heed of my curiosity. I tried to draw him back to his story with questions. Where did you go? I said. When? When you left Capri. Southwest, he said, and glanced at me for a second. We went in a boat. But I should have thought an aeroplane? They had been seized. I questioned him no more. Presently I thought he was beginning again. He broke out in an argumentative monotone. But why should it be? If, indeed, this battle, this slaughter and stress is life, why have we this craving for pleasure and beauty? If there is no refuge, if there is no place of peace, and if all our dreams of quiet places are a folly and a snare, why have we such dreams? Surely it was no ignoble cravings, no base intentions, had brought us to this. It was love that isolated us. Love had come to me with her eyes and robed in her beauty, more glorious than all else in life, in the very shape and color of life, and summon me away. I had silenced all the voices, I had answered all the questions I had come to her. And suddenly there was nothing but war and death. I had an inspiration. After all, I said, it could have been only a dream. A dream, he cried, flaming upon me, a dream when, even now. For the first time he became animated. A faint flush crept into his cheek. He raised his open hand and clenched it, and dropped it to his knee. He spoke, looking away from me, and for all the rest of the time he looked away. We are but phantoms, he said, and the phantoms of phantoms, desires like cloud shadows and wills of straw that eddy in the wind. The days pass, use and want carry us through as a train carries the shadow of its light, so be it. But one thing is real and certain, one thing is no dream stuff, but eternal and enduring. It is the center of my life, and all other things about it are subordinate or altogether vain. I loved her, that woman of a dream. And she and I are dead together. A dream. How can it be a dream, when it drenched a living life with unappeasable sorrow, when it makes all that I have lived for and cared for, worthless and unmeaning? Until that very moment when she was killed, I believed we had still a chance of getting away, he said. All through the night and morning that we sailed across the sea from Capri to Salerno, we talked of escape. We were full of hope, and it clung about us to the end, hope for the life together we should lead, out of it all, out of the battle and struggle, the wild and empty passions, the empty arbitrary thou shalt and thou shalt not of the world. We were uplifted, as though our quest was a holy thing, as though love for another was a mission. Even when from our boat we saw the fair face of that great rock Capri already scarred and gashed by the gun emplacements and hiding places that were to make it a fastness, we reckoned nothing of the imminent slaughter, though the fury of preparation hung about in the puffs and clouds of dust at 100 points amidst the grey, but, indeed, I made a text of that and talked. There, you know, was the rock, still beautiful for all its scars, with its countless windows and arches and ways, tier upon tier, for 1,000 feet, a vast carving of grey, broken by vine-clad terraces, and lemon and orange groves, and masses of agave and prickly pear, and puffs of almond blossom. And out under the archway that is built over the Piccola Marina other boats were coming, and as we came round the cape and within sight of the mainland, another little string of boats came into view, driving before the wind towards the southwest. In a little while a multitude had come out, the remoter just little specks of ultramarine in the shadow of the eastward cliff. It is love and reason, I said, fleeing from all this madness of war. And though we presently saw a squadron of aeroplanes flying across the southern sky, we did not heed it. There it was, a line of little dots in the sky, and then more, dotting the southeastern horizon, and then still more, until all that quarter of the sky was stippled with blue specks. Now they were all thin little strokes of blue, and now one and now a multitude would heel and catch the sun and become short flashes of light. They came, rising and falling and growing larger, like some huge flight of gulls or rooks or such-like birds, moving with a marvelous uniformity, and ever as they drew nearer they spread over a greater width of sky. The southward wind flung itself in an arrow-headed cloud athwart the sun. And then suddenly they swept round to the eastward and streamed eastward, growing smaller and smaller and clearer again until they vanished from the sky. And after that we noted to the northward and very high Evesham's fighting machines hanging high over Naples like an evening swarm of gnats. It seemed to have no more to do with us than a flight of birds. Even the mutter of guns far away in the southeast seemed to us to signify nothing. Each day, each dream after that, we were still exalted, still seeking that refuge where we might live and love. Fatigue had come upon us, pain and many distresses. For though we were dusty and stained by our toilsome tramping, and half-starved and with the horror of the dead men we had seen and the flight of the peasants, for very soon a gust of fighting swept up the peninsula with these things haunting our minds, it still resulted only in a deepening resolution to escape. Oh, but she was brave and patient. She who had never faced hardship and exposure had courage for herself and me. We went to and fro seeking an outlet, over a country all commandeered and ransacked by the gathering hosts of war. Always we went on foot. At first there were other fugitives, but we did not mingle with them. Some escaped northward, some were caught in the torrent of peasantry that swept along the main roads, many gave themselves into the hands of the soldiery and were sent northward. Many of the men were impressed. But we kept away from these things, we had brought no money to bribe a passage north, and I feared for my lady at the hands of these conscript crowds. We had landed at Salerno, and we had been turned back from Cava, and we had tried to cross towards Taranto by a pass over Mount Alberno, but we had been driven back for want of food, and so we had come down among the marshes by Pastum, where those great temples stand alone. I had some vague idea that by Pastum it might be possible to find a boat or something, and take once more to sea. And there it was, the battle overtook us. A sort of soul blindness had me. Plainly I could see that we were being hemmed in, that the great net of that giant warfare had us in its toils. Many times we had seen the levies that had come down from the north going to and fro, and had come upon them in the distance amidst the mountains making ways for the ammunition and preparing the mounting of the guns. Once we fancied they had fired at us, taking us for spies. At any rate a shot had gone shuddering over us. Several times we had hidden in woods from hovering aeroplanes. But all these things do not matter now. These nights of flight and pain, we were in an open place near those great temples at Pastum, at last, on a blank stony place dotted with spiky bushes, empty and desolate and so flat that a grove of eucalyptus far away showed to the feet of its stems. How I can see it! My lady was sitting down under a bush resting a little, for she was very weak and weary, and I was standing up watching to see if I could tell the distance of the firing that came and went. They were still, you know, fighting far from each other, with those terrible new weapons that had never before been used, guns that would carry beyond sight, and aeroplanes that would do what they would do no man could foretell. I knew that we were between the two armies, and that they drew together. I knew we were in danger, and that we could not stop there and rest. Though all these things were in my mind, they were in the background. They seemed to be affairs beyond our concern. Chiefly, I was thinking of my lady. An aching distress filled me. For the first time she had owned herself beaten and had fallen a weeping. Behind me I could hear her sobbing, but I would not turn round to her because I knew she had need of weeping, and had held herself so far and so long for me. It was well, I thought, that she would weep and rest and then we would toil on again, for I had no inkling of the thing that hung so near. Even now I can see her as she sat there, her lovely hair upon her shoulder, can mark again the deepening hollow of her cheek. "If we had parted," she said, "if I had let you go." "No," said I. "Even now, I do not repent. I will not repent, I made my choice, and I will hold on to the end." And then, overhead in the sky flashed something and burst, and all about us I heard the bullets making a noise like a handful of peas suddenly thrown. They chipped the stones about us, and whirled fragments from the bricks and passed. He put his hand to his mouth, and then moistened his lips. At the flash I had turned about. "You know," she stood up. She stood up, you know, and moved a step towards me as though she wanted to reach me. And she had been shot through the heart. He stopped and stared at me. I felt all that foolish incapacity an Englishman feels on such occasions. I met his eyes for a moment, and then stared out of the window. For a long space we kept silence. When at last I looked at him he was sitting back in his corner, his arms folded, and his teeth gnawing at his knuckles. He bit his nail suddenly, and stared at it. "I carried her," he said, "towards the temples, in my arms as though it mattered. I don't know why. They seemed a sort of sanctuary, you know, they had lasted so long, I suppose. She must have died almost instantly. Only I talked to her all the way." Silence again. "I have seen those temples," I said abruptly, and indeed he had brought those still, sunlit arcades of worn sandstone very vividly before me. It was the brown one, the big brown one. I sat down on a fallen pillar and held her in my arms, silent after the first babble was over. And after a little while the lizards came out and ran about again, as though nothing unusual was going on, as though nothing had changed. It was tremendously still there, the sun high and the shadows still, even the shadows of the weeds upon the entablature were still in spite of the thudding and banging that went all about the sky. I seemed to remember that the aeroplanes came up out of the south, and that the battle went away to the west. One aeroplane was struck, and overset and fell. I remember that though it didn't interest me in the least. It didn't seem to signify. It was like a wounded gull, you know, flapping for a time in the water. I could see it down the aisle of the temple, a black thing in the bright blue water. Three or four times shells burst about the beach, and then that ceased. Each time that happened all the lizards scuttled in and hid for a space. That was all the mischief done, except that once a stray bullet gashed the stone hard by made just a fresh bright surface. As the shadows grew longer, the stillness seemed greater. "The curious thing," he remarked, with the manner of a man who makes a trivial conversation, "is that I didn't think at all. I sat with her in my arms amidst the stones in a sort of lethargy stagnant. And I don't remember waking up. I don't remember dressing that day. I know I found myself in my office, with my letters all slid open in front of me, and how I was struck by the absurdity of being there, seeing that in reality I was sitting, stunned, in that past-doom temple with a dead woman in my arms. I read my letters like a machine. I have forgotten what they were about. He stopped, and there was a long silence. Suddenly I perceived that we were running down the incline from Chalk Farm to Euston. I started at this passing of time. I turned on him with a brutal question, with the tone of now or never. And did you dream again? Yes. He seemed to force himself to finish. His voice was very low. Once more, and as it were only for a few instants. I seemed to have suddenly awakened out of a great apathy, to have risen into a sitting position, and the body lay there on the stones beside me. A gaunt body. Not her, you know. So soon it was not her. I may have heard voices. I do not know. Only I knew clearly that men were coming into the solitude and that was the last outrage. I stood up and walked through the temple, and then there came into sight first one man with a yellow face, dressed in a uniform of dirty white, trimmed with blue, and then several, climbing to the crest of the old wall of the vanished city, and crouching there. They were little bright figures in the sunlight, and there they hung, weapon in hand, peering cautiously before them. And further away I saw others and then more at another point in the wall. It was a long lax line of men in open order. Presently the man I had first seen stood up and shouted a command, and his men came tumbling down the wall and into the high weeds towards the temple. He scrambled down with them and led them. He came facing towards me, and when he saw me he stopped. At first I had watched these men with a mere curiosity, but when I had seen they meant to come to the temple I was moved to forbid them. I shouted to the officer. "You must not come here," I cried, "I am here. I am here with my dead." He stared, and then shouted a question back to me in some unknown tongue. I repeated what I had said. He shouted again, and I folded my arms and stood still. Presently he spoke to his men and came forward. He carried a drawn sword. I signed to him to keep away, but he continued to advance. I told him again very patiently and clearly, "You must not come here. These are old temples and I am here with my dead." Presently he was so close I could see his face clearly. It was a narrow face, with dull gray eyes, and a black mustache. He had a scar on his upper lip, and he was dirty and unshaven. He kept shouting unintelligible things, questions, perhaps, at me. I know now that he was afraid of me, but at the time that did not occur to me. As I tried to explain to him, he interrupted me in imperious tones, bidding me, I suppose, stand aside. He made to go past me, and I caught hold of him. I saw his face change at my grip. "You fool," I cried. "Don't you know? She is dead." He started back. He looked at me with cruel eyes. I saw a sort of exultant resolve leap into them delight. Then, suddenly, with a scowl, he swept his sword back so and thrust. He stopped abruptly. I became aware of a change in the rhythm of the train. The brakes lifted their voices and the carriage jarred and jerked. This present world insisted upon itself, became clamorous. I saw through the steamy window huge electric lights glaring down from tall masts upon a fog, saw rows of stationary empty carriages passing by, and then a signal box hoisting its constellation of green and red into the murky London twilight, marched after them. I looked again at his drawn features. He ran me through the heart. It was with a sort of astonishment, no fear, no pain but just amazement, that I felt it pierce me, felt the sword drive home into my body. It didn't hurt, you know. It didn't hurt at all. The yellow platform lights came into the field of view, passing first rapidly, then slowly, and at last stopping with a jerk. Dim shapes of men passed to and fro without. "Euston," cried a voice. "Do you mean?" There was no pain, no sting or smart. Amazement and then darkness sweeping over everything. The hot, brutal face before me, the face of the man who had killed me, seemed to recede. It swept out of existence. "Euston," clamored the voices outside, "Euston." The carriage door opened, admitting a flood of sound, and a porter stood regarding us. The sounds of doors slamming, and the hoof clatter of cab horses, and behind these things the featureless remote roar of the London cobblestones, came to my ears. A truckload of lighted lamps blazed along the platform. A darkness, a flood of darkness that opened and spread and blotted out all things. "Any luggage, sir?" said the porter. "And that was the end?" I asked. He seemed to hesitate. Then, almost inaudibly, He answered, "No."
"You mean?"
"I couldn't get to her. She was there on the other side of the temple and then."
"Yes," I insisted.
"Yes?"
"Nightmares," he cried, "nightmares indeed. My God. Great birds that fought and tore. In truth, the mastery of flying was the work of thousands of men, this man a suggestion and that an experiment, until at last only one vigorous intellectual effort was needed to finish the work. But the inexorable injustice of the popular mind has decided that of all these thousands, one man, and that a man who never flew, should be chosen as the discoverer, just as it is chosen to honor Watt as the discoverer of steam and Stephenson of the steam engine. And surely of all honored names, none is so grotesquely and tragically honored as poor Filmer's, the timid, intellectual creature who solved the problem over which the world had hung perplexed and a little fearful for so many generations, the man who pressed the button that has changed peace and warfare and well-nigh every condition of human life and happiness. Never has that recurring wonder of the littleness of the scientific man in the face of the greatness of his science found such an amazing exemplification. Much concerning Filmer is, and must remain, profoundly obscure. Filmer's attract no Boswell's, but the essential facts and the concluding scene are clear enough, and there are letters, and notes, and casual allusions to piece the whole together. And this is the story one makes, putting this thing with that, of Filmer's life and death. The first authentic trace of Filmer on the page of history is a document in which he applies for admission as a paid student in physics to the government laboratories at South Kensington, and therein he describes himself as the son of a military bootmaker, cobbler in the vulgar tongue, of Dover, and lists his various examination proofs of a high proficiency in chemistry and mathematics. With a certain one of dignity, he seeks to enhance these attainments by a profession of poverty and disadvantages, and he writes of the laboratory as the jail of his ambitions, a slip which reinforces his claim to have devoted himself exclusively to the exact sciences. The document is endorsed in a manner that shows Filmer was admitted to this coveted opportunity, but until quite recently no traces of his success in the government institution could be found. It has now, however, been shown that in spite of his professed zeal for research, Filmer, before he had held this scholarship a year, was tempted, by the possibility of a small increase in his immediate income, to abandon it in order to become one of the 9-pence-an-hour computers employed by a well-known professor in his vicarious conduct of those extensive researches of his in solar physics researches which are still a matter of perplexity to astronomers. Afterwards, for the space of 7 years, save for the pass lists of the London University, in which he is seen to climb slowly to a double first-class BSc, in mathematics and chemistry, there is no evidence of how Filmer passed his life. No one knows how or where he lived, though it seems highly probable that he continued to support himself by teaching while he prosecuted the studies necessary for this distinction. And then, oddly enough, one finds him mentioned in the correspondence of Arthur Hicks, the poet. "You remember Filmer?" Hicks writes to his friend Vance. "Well, he hasn't altered a bit, the same hostile mumble and the nasty chin. How can a man contrive to be always 3 days from shaving? And a sort of furtive air of being engaged in sneaking in front of one, even his coat and that frayed collar of his show no further signs of the passing years. He was writing in the library and I sat down beside him in the name of God's charity, whereupon he deliberately insulted me by covering up his memoranda. It seems he has some brilliant research on hand that he suspects me of all people with a Bodley booklet of printing. Of stealing. He has taken remarkable honors at the university. He went through them with a sort of hasty slobber, as though he feared I might interrupt him before he had told me all, and he spoke of taking his D.S.C. as one might speak of taking a cab. And he asked what I was doing with a sort of comparative accent, and his arm was spread nervously, positively a protecting arm, over the paper that hid the precious idea, his one hopeful idea. Poetry, he said, poetry. And what do you profess to teach in it, Hicks? The thing's a provincial professorling in the very act of budding. And I thank the Lord devoutly that, but for the precious gift of indolence, I also might have gone this way to D.S.C. and destruction. A curious little vignette that I am inclined to think caught Filmer in or near the very birth of his discovery. Hicks was wrong in anticipating a provincial professorship for Filmer. Our next glimpse of him is lecturing on rubber and rubber substitutes. To the Society of Arts, he had become manager to a great plastic substance manufactory, and at that time, it is now known, he was a member of the Aeronautical Society. Albeit he contributed nothing to the discussions of that body, preferring no doubt to mature his great conception without external assistance. And within 2 years of that paper before the Society of Arts, he was hastily taking out a number of patents and proclaiming in various undignified ways the completion of the divergent inquiries which made his flying machine possible. The first definite statement to that effect appeared in a halfpenny evening paper through the agency of a man who lodged in the same house with Filmer. His final haste after his long laborious secret patience seems to have been due to a needless panic. Bootle, the notorious American scientific quack,
having made an announcement that Filmer interpreted wrongly as an anticipation of his idea. Now, what precisely was Filmer's idea? Really a very simple one. Before his time, the pursuit of aeronautics had taken two divergent lines, and had developed on the one hand balloons, large apparatus lighter than air, easy in ascent, and comparatively safe in descent, but floating helplessly before any breeze that took them, and on the other, flying machines that flew only in theory, vast flat structures heavier than air, propelled and kept up by heavy engines and for the most part smashing at the first descent. But, neglecting the fact that the inevitable final collapse rendered them impossible, the weight of the flying machines gave them this theoretical advantage, that they could go through the air against a wind, a necessary condition if aerial navigation was to have any practical value. It is Filmer's particular merit that he perceived the way in which the contrasted and hitherto incompatible merits of balloon and heavy flying machine might be combined in one apparatus, which should be at choice either heavier or lighter than air. He took hints from the contractile bladders of fish and the pneumatic cavities of birds. He devised an arrangement of contractile and absolutely closed balloons which, when expanded, could lift the actual flying apparatus with ease, and when retracted by the complicated musculature he wove about them, were withdrawn almost completely into the frame, and he built the large framework which these balloons sustained, of hollow, rigid tubes, the air in which, by an ingenious contrivance, was automatically pumped out as the apparatus fell, and which then remained exhausted so long as the aeronaut desired. There were no wings or propellers to his machine, such as there had been to all previous aeroplanes, and the only engine required was the compact and powerful little appliance needed to contract the balloons. He perceived that such an apparatus as he had devised might rise with frame exhausted and balloons expanded to a considerable height, might then contract its balloons and let the air into its frame, and by an adjustment of its weight slide down the air in any desired direction. As it fell, it would accumulate velocity and at the same time lose weight, and the momentum accumulated by its down rush could be utilized by means of a shifting of its weights to drive it up in the air again as the balloons expanded. This conception, which is still the structural conception of all successful flying machines, needed, however, a vast amount of toil upon its details before it could actually be realized, and such toil Filmer, as he was accustomed to tell the numerous interviewers who crowded upon him in the heyday of his fame, ungrudgingly and unsparingly gave. His particular difficulty was the elastic lining of the contractile balloon. He found he needed a new substance, and in the discovery and manufacture of that new substance he had, as he never failed to impress upon the interviewers, performed a far more arduous work than even in the actual achievement of my seemingly greater discovery. But it must not be imagined that these interviews followed hard upon Filmer's proclamation of his invention. An interval of nearly 5 years elapsed during which he timidly remained at his rubber factory. He seems to have been entirely dependent on his small income from this source, making misdirected attempts to assure a quite indifferent public that he really had invented what he had invented. He occupied the greater part of his leisure in the composition of letters to the scientific and daily press, and so forth, stating precisely the net result of his contrivances, and demanding financial aid. That alone would have sufficed for the suppression of his letters. He spent such holidays as he could arrange in unsatisfactory interviews with the doorkeepers of leading London papers. He was singularly not adapted for inspiring hall porters with confidence, and he positively attempted to induce the War Office to take up his work with him. There remains a confidential letter from Major General Volleyfire to the Earl of Frogs. "The man's a crank and a bounder to boot," says the Major General in his bluff, sensible, army way, and so left it open for the Japanese to secure, as they subsequently did, the priority in this side of warfare, a priority they still to our great discomfort retain. And then by a stroke of luck the membrane Filmer had invented for his contractile balloon was discovered to be useful for the valves of a new oil engine, and he obtained the means for making a trial model of his invention. He threw up his rubber factory appointment, desisted from all further writing, and, with a certain secrecy that seems to have been an inseparable characteristic of all his proceedings, set to work upon the apparatus. He seems to have directed the making of its parts and collected most of it in a room in Shoreditch, but its final putting together was done at Dymchurch, in Kent. He did not make the affair large enough to carry a man, but he made an extremely ingenious use of what were then called the Marconi rays to control its flight. The first flight of this first practicable flying machine took place over some fields near Burford Bridge, near Hythe, in Kent, and Filmer followed and controlled its flight upon a specially constructed motor tricycle. The flight was, considering all things, an amazing success. The apparatus was brought in a cart from Dymchurch to Burford Bridge, ascended there to a height of nearly 300 feet, swooped thence very nearly back to Dymchurch, came about in its sweep, rose again, circled, and finally sank uninjured in a field behind the Burford Bridge Inn. At its descent a curious thing happened. Filmer got off his tricycle, scrambled over the intervening dike, advanced perhaps 20 yards towards his triumph, threw out his arms in a strange gesticulation, and fell down in a dead faint. Everyone could then recall the ghastliness of his features and all the evidences of extreme excitement they had observed throughout the trial, things they might otherwise have forgotten. Afterwards, in the inn, he had an unaccountable gust of hysterical weeping. Altogether, there were not 20 witnesses of this affair, and those for the most part uneducated men. The new Romney doctor saw the ascent but not the descent, his horse being frightened by the electrical apparatus on Filmer's tricycle and giving him a nasty spill. Two members of the Kent Constabulary watched the affair from a cart in an unofficial spirit, and a grocer calling round the marsh for orders and two lady cyclists seem almost to complete the list of educated people. There were two reporters present, one representing a Folkestone paper and the other being a fourth-class interviewer and symposium journalist, whose expenses down, Filmer, anxious as ever for adequate advertisement and now quite realizing the way in which adequate advertisement may be obtained, had paid. The latter was one of those writers who can throw a convincing air of unreality over the most credible events, and his half-facetious account of the affair appeared in the magazine page of a popular journal. But, happily for Filmer, this person's colloquial methods were more convincing. He went to offer some further screed upon the subject to Banghurst, the proprietor of the new paper, and one of the ablest and most unscrupulous men in London journalism, and Banghurst instantly seized upon the situation. The interviewer vanishes from the narrative, no doubt very doubtfully remunerated, and Banghurst himself, double chin, grey twill suit, abdomen, voice, gestures and all, appears at Dymchurch, following his large, unrivaled journalistic nose. He had seen the whole thing at a glance, just what it was and what it might be. At his touch, as it were, Filmer's long-penned investigations exploded into fame. He instantly and most magnificently was a boom. One turns over the files of the journals of the year 1907 with a quite incredulous recognition of how swift and flaming the boom of those days could be. The July papers know nothing of flying, see nothing in flying, state by a most effective silence that men never would, could or should fly. In August, flying and Filmer and flying and parachutes and aerial tactics and the Japanese government and Filmer and again flying, shoulder the war in Yunnan and the gold mines of Upper Greenland off the leading page. And Banghurst had given £10,000, and, further, Banghurst was giving £5,000, and Banghurst had devoted his well-known, magnificent, but hitherto sterile, private laboratories and several acres of land near his private residence on the Surrey Hills to the strenuous and violent completion Banghurst fashion of the life-size practicable flying machine. Meanwhile, in the sight of privileged multitudes in the walled garden of the Banghurst town residence in Fulham, Filmer was exhibited at weekly garden parties putting the working model through its paces. At enormous initial cost, but with a final profit, the new paper presented its readers with a beautiful photographic souvenir of the first of these occasions. Here again the correspondence of Arthur Hicks and his friend Vance comes to our aid. "I saw Filmer in his glory," he writes, with just the touch of envy natural to his position as a poet passé. The man is brushed and shaved, dressed in the fashion of a Royal Institution afternoon lecturer, the very newest shape in frock coats and long patent shoes, and altogether in a state of extraordinary streakiness between an owlish great man and a scared abashed self-conscious bounder cruelly exposed. He hasn't a touch of color in the skin of his face, his head juts forward, and those queer little dark amber eyes of his watch furtively round him for his fame. His clothes fit perfectly and yet sit upon him as though he had bought them ready-made. He speaks in a mumble still, but he says, "You perceive indistinctly, enormous self-assertive things." He backs into the rear of groups by instinct if Banghurst drops the line for a minute, and when he walks across Banghurst's lawn one perceives him a little out of breath and going jerky, and that his weak white hands are clenched. His is a state of tension, horrible tension. And he is the greatest discoverer of this or any age, the greatest discoverer of this or any age. What strikes one so forcibly about him is that he didn't somehow quite expect it ever, at any rate, not at all like this. Banghurst is about everywhere, the energetic MC of his great little catch, and I swear he will have every one down on his lawn there before he has finished with the engine. He had bagged the Prime Minister yesterday, and he, bless his heart, didn't look particularly outsize, on the very first occasion. Conceive it. Filmer. Our obscure unwashed Filmer, the glory of British science. Duchesses crowd upon him, beautiful, bold peeresses say in their beautiful, clear loud voices, "Have you noticed how penetrating the great lady is becoming nowadays? Oh, Mr. Filmer, how did you do it?" Common men on the edge of things are too remote for the answer. One imagines something in the way of that interview, toil ungrudgingly and unsparingly given, madam, and, perhaps I don't know but perhaps a little special aptitude. So far Hicks, and the photographic supplement to the new paper is in sufficient harmony with the description. In one picture the machine swings down towards the river, and the tower of Fulham Church appears below it through a gap in the elms, and in another, Filmer sits at his guiding batteries, and the great and beautiful of the earth stand around him, with Banghurst massed modestly but resolutely in the rear. The grouping is oddly apposite. Occluding much of Banghurst, and looking with a pensive, speculative expression at Filmer, stands the Lady Mary Elkinghorn, still beautiful, in spite of the breath of scandal and her 38 years, the only person whose face does not admit a perception of the camera that was in the act of snapping them all. So much for the exterior facts of the story, but, after all, they are very exterior facts. About the real interest of the business, one is necessarily very much in the dark. How was Filmer feeling at the time? How much was a certain unpleasant anticipation present inside that very new and fashionable frock coat? He was in the halfpenny, penny, sixpenny, and more expensive papers alike, and acknowledged by the whole world as the greatest discoverer of this or any age. He had invented a practicable flying machine, and every day down among the Surrey Hills the life-sized model was getting ready. And when it was ready, it followed as a clear inevitable consequence of his having invented and made it everybody in the world, indeed, seemed to take it for granted. There wasn't a gap anywhere in that serried front of anticipation that he would proudly and cheerfully get aboard it, ascend with it, and fly. But we know now pretty clearly that simple pride and cheerfulness in such an act were singularly out of harmony with Filmer's private constitution. It occurred to no one at the time, but there the fact is. We can guess with some confidence now that it must have been drifting about in his mind a great deal during the day, and, from a little note to his physician complaining of persistent insomnia, we have the soundest reason for supposing it dominated his nights, the idea that it would be, after all, in spite of his theoretical security, an abominably sickening, uncomfortable, and dangerous thing for him to flap about in nothingness 1,000 feet or so in the air. It must have dawned upon him quite early in the period of being the greatest discoverer of this or any age, the vision of doing this and that with an extensive void below. Perhaps someone in his youth he had looked down a great height or fallen down in some excessively uncomfortable way, perhaps some habit of sleeping on the wrong side had resulted in that disagreeable falling nightmare one knows, and given him his horror. Of the strength of that horror there remains now not a particle of doubt. Apparently he had never weighed this duty of flying in his earlier days of research. The machine had been his end, but now things were opening out beyond his end, and particularly this giddy whirl up above there. He was a discoverer and he had discovered. But he was not a flying man, and it was only now that he was beginning to perceive clearly that he was expected to fly. Yet, however much the thing was present in his mind, he gave no expression to it until the very end, and meanwhile he went to and fro from Banghurst's magnificent laboratories, and was interviewed and lionized, and wore good clothes, and ate good food, and lived in an elegant flat, enjoying a very abundant feast of such good, coarse, wholesome fame and success as a man, starved for all his years as he had been starved, might be reasonably expected to enjoy. After a time, the weekly gatherings in Fulham ceased. The model had failed one day just for a moment to respond to Filmer's guidance, or he had been distracted by the compliments of an archbishop. At any rate, it suddenly dug its nose into the air just a little too steeply as the archbishop was sailing through a Latin quotation for all the world like an archbishop in a book, and it came down in the Fulham Road within 3 yards of a bus horse. It stood for a second perhaps, astonishing and in its attitude astonished, then it crumpled, shivered into pieces, and the bus horse was incidentally killed. Filmer lost the end of the archiepiscopal compliment. He stood up and stared as his invention swooped out of sight and reach of him. His long, white hand still gripped his useless apparatus. The archbishop followed his skyward stare with an apprehension unbecoming in an archbishop. Then came the crash and the shouts and uproar from the road to relieve Filmer's tension. "My God," he whispered, and sat down. Everyone else almost was staring to see where the machine had vanished, or rushing into the house. The making of the big machine progressed all the more rapidly for this. Over its making presided Filmer, always a little slow and very careful in his manner, always with a growing preoccupation in his mind. His care over the strength and soundness of the apparatus was prodigious. The slightest doubt, and he delayed everything until the doubtful part could be replaced. Wilkinson, his senior assistant, fumed at some of these delays, which, he insisted, were for the most part unnecessary. Banghurst magnified the patient certitude of Filmer in the new paper, and reviled it bitterly to his wife, and McAndrew, the second assistant, approved Filmer's wisdom. "We're not wanting a fiasco, man," said McAndrew. "He's perfectly well advised." And whenever an opportunity arose, Filmer would expound to Wilkinson and McAndrew just exactly how every part of the flying machine was to be controlled and worked, so that in effect they would be just as capable, and even more capable, when at last the time came, of guiding it through the skies. Now I should imagine that if Filmer had seen fit at this stage to define just what he was feeling, and to take a definite line in the matter of his ascent, he might have escaped that painful ordeal quite easily. If he had had it clearly in his mind, he could have done endless things. He would surely have found no difficulty with a specialist to demonstrate a weak heart, or something gastric or pulmonary, to stand in his way, that is the line I am astonished he did not take, or he might, had he been man enough, have declared simply and finally that he did not intend to do the thing. But the fact is, though the dread was hugely present in his mind, the thing was by no means sharp and clear. I fancy that all through this period he kept telling himself that when the occasion came he would find himself equal to it. He was like a man just gripped by a great illness, who says he feels a little out of sorts, and expects to be better presently. Meanwhile he delayed the completion of the machine, and let the assumption that he was going to fly it take root and flourish exceedingly about him. He even accepted anticipatory compliments on his courage. And, barring this secret squeamishness, there can be no doubt he found all the praise and distinction and fuss he got a delightful and even intoxicating draft. The Lady Mary Elkinghorn made things a little more complicated for him. How that began was a subject of inexhaustible speculation to Hicks. Probably in the beginning she was just a little nice to him with that impartial partiality of hers, and it may be that to her eyes, standing out conspicuously as he did ruling his monster in the upper air, he had a distinction that Hicks was not disposed to find. And somehow they must have had a moment of sufficient isolation, and the great discoverer a moment of sufficient courage for something just a little personal to be mumbled or blurted. However it began, there is no doubt that it did begin, and presently became quite perceptible to a world accustomed to find in the proceedings of the Lady Mary Elkinghorn a matter of entertainment. It complicated things, because the state of love in such a virgin mind as Filmer's would brace his resolution, if not sufficiently, at any rate considerably towards facing a danger he feared, and hampered him in such attempts at evasion as would otherwise be natural and congenial. It remains a matter for speculation just how the Lady Mary felt for Filmer and just what she thought of him. At 38 one may have gathered much wisdom and still be not altogether wise, and the imagination still functions actively enough in creating glamours and effecting the impossible. He came before her eyes as a very central man, and that always counts, and he had powers, unique powers as it seemed, at any rate in the air. The performance with the model had just a touch of the quality of a potent incantation, and women have ever displayed an unreasonable disposition to imagine that when a man has powers he must necessarily have power. Given so much, and what was not good in Filmer's manner and appearance became an added merit. He was modest, he hated display, but given an occasion where true qualities are needed, then one would see. The late Mrs. Bampton thought it wise to convey to Lady Mary her opinion that Filmer, all things considered, was rather a grub. "He's certainly not a sort of man I have ever met before," said the Lady Mary, with a quite unruffled serenity. And Mrs. Bampton, after a swift, imperceptible glance at that serenity, decided that so far as saying anything to Lady Mary went, she had done as much as could be expected of her. But she said a great deal to other people. And at last, without any undue haste or unseemliness, the day dawned, the great day, when Banghurst had promised his public the world in fact that flying should be finally attained and overcome. Filmer saw it dawn, watched even in the darkness before it dawned, watched its stars fade and the grey and pearly pinks give place at last to the clear blue sky of a sunny, cloudless day. He watched it from the window of his bedroom in the new-built wing of Banghurst's Tudor house. And as the stars were overwhelmed and the shapes and substances of things grew into being out of the amorphous dark, he must have seen more and more distinctly the festive preparations beyond the beech clumps near the green pavilion in the outer park, the three stands for the privileged spectators, the raw, new fencing of the enclosure, the sheds and workshops, the Venetian masts and fluttering flags that Banghurst had considered essential, black and limp in the breezeless dawn. And amidst all these things a great shape covered with tarpauling. A strange and terrible portent for humanity was that shape, a beginning that must surely spread and widen and change and dominate all the affairs of men, but to Filmer it is very doubtful whether it appeared in anything but a narrow and personal light. Several people heard him pacing in the small hours, for the vast place was packed with guests by a proprietor-editor who, before all, understood compression. And about 5 o'clock, if not before, Filmer left his room and wandered out of the sleeping house into the park, alive by that time with sunlight and birds and squirrels and the fallow deer. McAndrew, who was also an early riser, met him near the machine, and they went and had a look at it together. It is doubtful if Filmer took any breakfast, in spite of the urgency of Banghurst. So soon as the guests began to be about in some number he seems to have retreated to his room. Thence about 10 he went into the shrubbery, very probably because he had seen the Lady Mary Elkinghorn there. She was walking up and down, engaged in conversation with her old school friend, Mrs. Bruce Craven, and although Filmer had never met the latter lady before, he joined them and walked beside them for some time. There were several silences in spite of the Lady Mary's brilliance. The situation was a difficult one, and Mrs. Bruce Craven did not master its difficulty. "He struck me," she said afterwards with a luminous self-contradiction, "as a very unhappy person who had something to say, and wanted before all things to be helped to say it. But how was one to help him when one didn't know what it was?" At 11:30 the enclosures for the public in the outer park were crammed, There was an intermittent stream of equipages along the belt which circles the outer park, and the house party was dotted over the lawn and shrubbery in the corner of the inner park, in a series of brilliantly attired knots, all making for the flying machine. Filmer walked in a group of three with Banghurst, who was supremely and conspicuously happy, and Sir Theodore Hickel, the president of the Aeronautical Society. Mrs. Banghurst was close behind with the Lady Mary Elkinghorn, Georgina Hickel, and the Dean of Stays. Banghurst was large and copious in speech, and such interstices as he left were filled in by Hickel with complimentary remarks to Filmer. And Filmer walked between them saying not a word except by way of unavoidable reply. Behind, Mrs. Banghurst listened to the admirably suitable and shapely conversation of the Dean with that fluttered attention to the ampler clergy 10 years of social ascent and ascendancy had not cured in her, and the Lady Mary watched, no doubt with an entire confidence in the world's disillusionment, the drooping shoulders of the sort of man she had never met before. There was some cheering as the central party came into view of the enclosures, but it was not very unanimous nor invigorating cheering. They were within 50 yards of the apparatus when Filmer took a hasty glance over his shoulder to measure the distance of the ladies behind them, and decided to make the first remark he had initiated since the house had been left. His voice was just a little hoarse, and he cut in on Banghurst in mid-sentence on progress. "I say, Banghurst," he said, and stopped. "Yes," said Banghurst. "I wish," he moistened his lips. "I'm not feeling well." Banghurst stopped dead. "Eh?" he shouted. "A queer feeling." Filmer made to move on, but Banghurst was immovable. "I don't know. I may be better in a minute. If not, perhaps, McAndrew." "You're not feeling well?" said Banghurst, and stared at his white face. "My dear," he said, as Mrs. Banghurst came up with them, "Filmer says he isn't feeling well." "A little queer," exclaimed Filmer, avoiding the Lady Mary's eyes. "It may pass off." There was a pause. It came to Filmer that he was the most isolated person in the world. "In any case," said Banghurst, "the ascent must be made. Perhaps if you were to sit down somewhere for a moment." "It's the crowd, I think," said Filmer. There was a second pause. Banghurst's eye rested in scrutiny on Filmer, and then swept the sample of public in the enclosure. "It's unfortunate," said Sir Theodore Hickel, "but still I suppose your assistance of course, if you feel out of condition and disinclined." "I don't think Mr. Filmer would permit that for a moment," said Lady Mary. "But if Mr. Filmer's nerve is run, it might even be dangerous for him to attempt," Hickel coughed. "It's just because it's dangerous," began the Lady Mary, and felt she had made her point of view and Filmer's plain enough. Conflicting motives struggled for Filmer. "I feel I ought to go up," he said, regarding the ground. He looked up and met the Lady Mary's eyes. "I want to go up," he said, and smiled whitely at her. He turned towards Banghurst. "If I could just sit down somewhere for a moment out of the crowd and sun." Banghurst, at least, was beginning to understand the case. "Come into my little room in the green pavilion," he said. "It's quite cool there." He took Filmer by the arm. Filmer turned his face to the Lady Mary Elkinghorn again. "I shall be all right in 5 minutes," he said. "I'm tremendously sorry." The Lady Mary Elkinghorn smiled at him. "I couldn't think," he said to Hickel, and obeyed the compulsion of Banghurst's pull. The rest remained watching the two recede. "He is so fragile," said the Lady Mary. "He's certainly a highly nervous type," said the Dean, whose weakness it was to regard the whole world, except married clergymen with enormous families, as neurotic. "Of course," said Hickel, "it isn't absolutely necessary for him to go up because he has invented." "How could he avoid it?" asked the Lady Mary, with the faintest shadow of scorn. "It's certainly most unfortunate if he's going to be ill now," said Mrs. Banghurst a little severely. "He's not going to be ill," said the Lady Mary, and certainly she had met Filmer's eye. "You'll be all right," said Banghurst, as they went towards the pavilion. "All you want is a nip of brandy. It ought to be you, you know. You'd get it rough, you know, if you let another man." "Oh, I want to go," said Filmer. "I shall be all right. As a matter of fact, I'm almost inclined now. No. I think I'll have that nip of brandy first." Banghurst took him into the little room and routed out an empty decanter. He departed in search of a supply. He was gone perhaps 5 minutes. The history of those 5 minutes cannot be written. At intervals, Filmer's face could be seen by the people on the easternmost of the stands erected for spectators, against the window pane peering out, and then it would recede and fade. Banghurst vanished shouting behind the grand stand, and presently the butler appeared going pavilionward with a tray. The apartment in which Filmer came to his last solution was a pleasant little room very simply furnished with green furniture, and an old bureau for Banghurst was simple in all his private ways. It was hung with little engravings after Moreland, and it had a shelf of books. but as it happened, Banghurst had left a rook rifle he sometimes played with on the top of the desk, and on the corner of the mantelshelf was a tin with three or four cartridges remaining in it. As Filmer went up and down that room wrestling with his intolerable dilemma, he went first towards the neat little rifle athwart the blotting pad and then towards the neat little red label. .22 long. The thing must have jumped into his mind in a moment. Nobody seems to have connected the report with him, though the gun, being fired in a confined space, must have sounded loud, and there were several people in the billiard room, separated from him only by a lath and plaster partition. But directly Banghurst's butler opened the door and smelt the sour smell of the smoke, he knew, he says, what had happened. For the servants at least of Banghurst's household had guessed something of what was going on in Filmer's mind. All through that trying afternoon Banghurst behaved as he held a man should behave in the presence of hopeless disaster, and his guests for the most part succeeded in not insisting upon the fact, though to conceal their perception of it altogether was impossible, that Banghurst had been pretty elaborately and completely swindled by the deceased. The public in the enclosure, Hicks told me, dispersed like a party that has been ducking a welsher, and there wasn't a soul in the train to London, it seems, who hadn't known all along that flying was a quite impossible thing for man. But he might have tried it, said many, after carrying the thing so far. In the evening, when he was comparatively alone, Banghurst broke down and went on like a man of clay. I have been told he wept, which must have made an imposing scene, and he certainly said Filmer had ruined his life, and offered and sold the whole apparatus to MacAndrew for half a crown. I've been thinking, said MacAndrew at the conclusion of the bargain, and stopped. The next morning the name of Filmer was, for the first time, less conspicuous in the new paper than in any other daily paper in the world. The rest of the world's instructors, with varying emphasis, according to their dignity and the degree of competition between themselves and the new paper, proclaimed the entire failure of the new flying machine, and suicide of the impostor. But in the district of North Surrey the reception of the news was tempered by a perception of unusual aerial phenomena. Overnight Wilkinson and MacAndrew had fallen into violent argument on the exact motives of their principal's rash act. The man was certainly a poor, cowardly body, but so far as his science went he was no impostor, said MacAndrew, and I'm prepared to give that proposition a very practical demonstration, Mr. Wilkinson, so soon as we've got the place a little more to ourselves. For I've no faith in all this publicity for experimental trials. And to that end, while all the world was reading of the certain failure of the new flying machine, MacAndrew was soaring and curvetting with great amplitude and dignity over the Epsom and Wimbledon divisions, and Banghurst, restored once more to hope and energy, and regardless of public security and the Board of Trade, was pursuing his gyrations and trying to attract his attention, on a motor car and in his pajamas he had caught sight of the ascent when pulling up the blind of his bedroom window equipped, among other things, with a film camera that was subsequently discovered to be jammed. And Filmer was lying on the billiard table in the Green Pavilion with a sheet about